From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Guy Raz. This episode, as fuel prices ease, summer flyers wonder, why do the airlines charge so much?
The really short answer? Because they can.
Our cover story, the fare way or the highway. We go by road and rail and air to look at cost. Also, a new exhibition of feminist author Juna Barnes' work, writer Anthony Swafford on fatherhood, and a rainy visit to a garden called Chanticleer.
It's macabre, but in a very sort of entertaining and eye-winking sort of way.
Plus, Pulitzer Prize winner Richard Ford on his new novel, Canada, Whoopi Goldberg on the movie she could watch a million times, and after 7 years, singer Bonnie Raitt's new album.
I just wanted to be Bonnie Raitt without the capitals, you know, I just wanted to see what it was like to live a regular life.
That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Let me recreate an experience I had a few weeks ago that perhaps you've had as well this summer. You check in on one of those travel websites like Kayak or Orbitz or Priceline. And let's look up DCA to Milwaukee, MKE. On every segment, I'm getting over $200. That means a $400 round-trip ticket for two people. That's $800. Then we have to pay extra for our bags, figure 25 bucks a piece. That's another 50 both ways. Now it's $100. $900. And that doesn't even include taxi to the airfare or perhaps, you know, we're going to take the metro to save money, right? You know, it's $1,000 just to go home to Milwaukee. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get in the car.
I've been hitting some hard traveling, I thought you know.
Which raises the question, why does the cost of travel, economic and psychic, seem higher than ever? We're going to talk planes and trains in a moment, but if you're like me, you're hitting the road this summer. Good luck with those potholes. They're not getting any smaller. Congress remains deadlocked over a new highway bill, and there's a faint hope that they'll reach an agreement before the current bill funding transportation projects expires at the end of the month. Without an agreement, highway projects across the nation will grind to a halt this summer, idling thousands of workers. NPR's Brian Naylor has more.
Back in the not-too-distant past, the highway bill was something that all lawmakers, senators and congresspeople, Republicans and Democrats could agree on. After all, what was not to like about the prospect of bringing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, back to your district or state to repave a bumpy highway, fix a crumbling bridge, or build a new bike path? But that was before the Bridge to Nowhere gave earmarks a bad name, and some conservatives started questioning whether the federal government should even be in the infrastructure business. Now the highway bill is stalled, as the headline writers are fond of saying. The Senate has passed a $109 billion two-year measure. The House was unable to agree on a bill, and Republican leaders there won't bring the Senate version to the floor. This week, a consortium of construction interests began running ads in some congressmen's districts, urging listeners to urge their lawmakers to act.
Look out the window. More than 600 bridges in the Oklahoma City area need significant repairs, but time is running out. Federal investment for Oklahoma's transportation programs ends on June 30th, unless Congress acts now. Will Congressman James Lankford be part of the problem or part of Oklahoma's transportation solution?
Oklahoma Republican James Lankford was unmoved. He told reporters his office had received as many as three calls as a result of the ad.
And I've yet to have a person that didn't hang up the phone and say, stick to your guns. So these ads that they're running telling us to try to get something done have actually, I think, backfired on them to solidify our base.
House Republicans are insisting that elimination of some environmental reviews and approval of the Keystone Pipeline be included in the measure. Democrats call those demands extremist. If, as seems likely, lawmakers can't agree on a bill by the end of the month, congressional leaders are expected to try to pass another temporary measure to fund projects until after the November election. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
I've been walking that Lincoln Highway, I thought you knowed.
Well, even though highways might not be in great shape, a road trip can, as we mentioned, be cheaper than flying. That's for all the usual reasons, fluctuating fuel costs, decreased domestic capacity, but in other ways, it's much more simple. I put this question to airfare savant Nicholas Kralev. He's the author of the book Decoding Air Travel. We asked him, why do airlines charge such high fees?
Because they can.
I was afraid of that.
airfares now are based on demand and supply because the airline industry hasn't been regulated since the 1970s. And so very often, if you fly very short distances, you do end up paying a lot of money because the airlines can afford to bump up the prices because supply is just so limited.
Now, it seems as if airfare is more expensive. And if you adjust for today's dollars, you know, it's relatively cheap. According to a trade magazine, Airlines for America, if the average fare in 1979 had kept pace with inflation, an average ticket today would cost $625. It actually cost an average of $365 last year. So should we think we're getting things cheap?
To be honest, I don't like these average things and generalizations because how does it affect you? Yes, fares that are published may be relatively lower, but there are all these extra fees now for luggage. The second bag to go to Europe, for example, is $100. How is that cheaper? I mean, it's not.
Nicholas Kralev, you travel all over the world and you spend a lot of time outside the U.S. looking at travel. How are we doing with our infrastructure, would you say, for transport compared to these other countries?
For a first world country and the world's most powerful country and largest economy, not too well. It was interesting that, particularly in the 90s, the American airlines decided that they would focus on quantity rather than quality. And so you see packed planes, you see cutbacks in service. And it sounds ridiculous when people don't even expect to get pretzels on the plane. But if you ask a frequent traveler, particularly business traveler, would you choose first class on a U.S. airline or an Asian airline? Of course, the answer would be Asian airline.
So if airlines can charge what they do simply because they can, what alternative do we have?
There are a couple of things we can do. And the first one is to subscribe to fare alerts. There are actually websites you can program, and I explained that in the book, how to, every time a fare drops, receive an email. And if you know you're going to go to that place more than once, get more than one ticket. I once got a fare of $36 to Phoenix from Washington. That is something that you should not be missed, and I bought two or three tickets that time. A sort of a peculiar routing might save you money. For example, if you'd need to go to Milwaukee, nobody would think about going through Las Vegas because it's way out of the way, right? Mm-hmm. But if your fare to Milwaukee is $800 or $1,000, what if going through Vegas cut that price in half and you don't have to buy two separate tickets? And one last thing, sometimes I've noticed that, shockingly, it may be cheaper to fly first class than coach. Hmm. I know it doesn't make sense, but this past week, there was a fare from Orlando to Chicago, $200 first class. Well, guess what? The last minute economy available was $300 each way. But who thinks of searching first class? We think it's outlandish, right? Well, sometimes it's not.
Nicholas Kralev. More tips are found in his book, Decoding Air Travel, a guide to saving on airfare and flying in luxury. To the rails now. The story of why rail travel isn't what it used to be is just that simple. It isn't what it used to be. Let's explain. Ever heard of the National Railroad Passenger Corporation?
East or west, north or south, past farm and village, through town and city, the railroads make America move.
The National Railroad Passenger Corporation was established under President Nixon in 1971 when it looked like the golden days of U.S. railroads were fading. It was essentially a government takeover of what was left of the passenger rail industry. It was quickly rebranded, though.
Amtrak, and it was an attempt by the federal government to make sure the passenger rail network, which was very robust in the years before World War II, but which was facing steady decline, was still available in many metropolitan areas.
Robert Fuentes is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. It was supposed to be a short-term fix. Rail travel was essentially on life support at the time. 75% of passenger train mileage had disappeared between 1958 and the early 70s.
You know, there probably was some kind of feeling that the passenger rail network was
Passé
was just really was not the gleaming new technological transportation investments that were being made all across the United States at the time.
Let's fast forward to 2010 with a clip from Barack Obama's first State of the Union address.
There's no reason Europe or China should have the fastest trains or the new factories that manufacture clean energy products. Tomorrow I'll visit Tampa, Florida. where workers will soon break ground on a new high-speed railroad funded by the Recovery Act. There are projects like that all across this country that will create jobs and help move our nation's goods, services, and information.
That sounds pretty good, Robert Puentes. What happened?
Clearly, the national economic challenges kind of overwhelm everything. But the important thing to remember is the way that the high-speed rail program came together is this money was actually held and was put into a competition. And so states in particular had to apply for the funds.
In fact, let me give you a couple of examples. Rick Scott in Florida, governor, rejects high-speed rail, as does John Kasich in Ohio, Scott Walker in Wisconsin. All these newly elected governors, the fall after the president's State of the Union remarks, all replaced governors who'd lobbied for hundreds of millions of dollars in high-speed rail funds.
Yeah, but each of those states, it's important to remember, actually applied for the funds. So I think that the way that it was framed, that the federal government was trying to shove money into these places that didn't want it, is disingenuous.
I want to ask you another question. You're an expert on infrastructure, and we're a country whose core infrastructure was built at a time when our population was, what, 250 million or over 300 million now? You only have to get out there to know that things are congested. We have a problem, whether it's trains, planes, or automobiles. But politically, there's no movement. When could we see that change?
There's no doubt there's little movement here in Washington. But when you leave Washington and you look at what's happening in states and metropolitan areas, you do see a lot of innovation. You see governors in Michigan and in Virginia and in other states that are starting to look very differently at their transportation network. You're starting to see investments in transit and some other technological innovations that may not be as sexy, but squeeze so much out of the system. So I think the federal government still has a lot of work to do, and I think they're ready to do that work, probably past the election. But I think the federal government is going to recognize what's happening in states and metropolitan areas and capitalize on all the innovations out there.
Robert Puente, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
I've been hitting some hard.
Juna Barnes referred to herself as the unknown legend of American literature, but the famously provocative lesbian writer makes a brief appearance in Woody Allen's Midnight in Paris. Owen Wilson dances the Charleston with her.
You look like you were having fun with Juna Barnes dancing.
Oh, yeah. Wait, that was Juna Barnes?
Yeah.
Wow, no wonder she wanted to lead.
That's Juna, D-J-U-N-A, a woman ahead of her time.
She was much more interested in embracing the quirky, almost, and embracing that sort of idea that became so famous in feminist circles, you know, half a century later, the idea of the personal is political.
That's curator Catherine Morris. She's brought Barnes's New York years back to life in a series called Newspaper Fictions at the Brooklyn Museum. The story goes that Barnes, who grew up with her mother, grandmother, polygamist father, his mistress and brothers she'd helped support, walked into the office of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle and denounced, "I can draw, I can write, you'd be foolish not to hire me." They did.
Part of the series that she, ongoing series that she did, was called Odd Types Found in and Around Brooklyn. So she would find individuals, strange people across class lines, across race lines, across all sort of social milieus, and kind of draw pictures for her audience, and literally draw pictures.
Her very first article for the Brooklyn Daily Eagle is on the wall. It's called You Can Tango a Little at Arcadia Dance Hall. We invited an actress to read a bit of it.
Reginald Delancey, which really isn't his name at all, but will do as well as any other to tack on to and distinguish this young man, lolled in a soft armchair in the window of his club in Clinton Street and scanned the evening papers. He was bored. The tips of his immaculate tan shoes shone brightly as ever. The creases in his trousers were like the prow of the Imperator in their incisive sharpness, but his mind was as dull as a tarnished teapot.
Barnes, like the so-called new journalists who came along in the 60s, like Tom Wolfe and Joan Didion, believed that the Observer colored the story, so why pretend otherwise? She also fabricated, or she'd make herself the story. Again, curator Catherine Morris.
A century before Christopher Hitchens was waterboarded, we have this example of what we would now call stunt journalism.
In the teens and 20s, suffragettes were being forcibly fed with long tubes in Britain during their hunger strikes for the vote. So here's Juna's dramatic take on having it done to her.
I shall be strictly professional, I assured myself. If it be an ordeal, it is familiar to my sex at this time. Other women have suffered it in acute reality. Surely I have as much nerve as my English sisters. Then I held myself steady. I thought so, and I caught sight of my face in the glass. It was quite white, and I was swallowing convulsively. and then I knew my soul stood terrified before a yard of red rubber tubing. He wrapped it round and round me, my arms tight to my sides, wrapped it up to my throat so that I could not move. I lay in as long and unbroken lines as any corpse. Unbroken, definite lines that stretched away beyond my vision. For I saw only skylight. My eyes wandered, outcasts in a world they knew.
The Brooklyn Museum exhibit of 45 articles and sketches is revealing because Juna Barnes is so much better known for her Paris years. She went there in 1921.
She interviewed people like James Joyce and others and became an active part of the really modern avant-gardes of Paris, both American and expatriate.
She returned to New York in the 30s and became a recluse, dying in 1982 in Greenwich Village. That would have been decades after she became famous in feminist circles for her novel Nightwood.
She really looked life in the face, and she didn't shy away from it in her writing or in her own decisions about her own life.
Juna Barnes lived that life at white heat, as if she thought that one day the music would stop.
Suddenly, the orchestra of eight pieces struck up a lively tune. And immediately, hundreds of gaily dressed girls and happy-looking men glided onto the floor and were two-stepping with vigor and vim. But there wasn't even so much as a wiggle of the shoulders to suggest the turkey trot. Reginald found that the sight of so many swaying bodies was infectious.
Much of her writing is out of print, but in newspaper fictions at the Brooklyn Museum, she lives. The exhibit's up through the summer.
We at war.
7 years ago, writer and former U.S. Marine Anthony Swofford had the success of a lifetime when his 2003 memoir, Jarhead, was turned into a high-budget Hollywood movie. For Swofford, then 35, he'd hit it big. The film was directed by Sam Mendes. It featured this track from Kanye West called Jesus Walks, and Swofford was played by the actor Jake Gyllenhaal.
Swofford!
Sir, yes, sir!
You the maggot whose father served in Vietnam?
Sir, yes, sir!
Outstanding! Did he have the balls to die there?
Sir, no, sir!
Too f- bad. He ever talk about it?
Sir, only once, sir!
Good! Then he wasn't lying!
That scene was especially true to life. Swofford's dad did serve in Vietnam, but he was also a destructive father and an unfaithful husband. And in the years after Jarhead, flush with cash, Anthony Swofford suddenly found himself becoming the one man he never wanted to be.
My father was, a philanderer in chief, I guess, certainly of our family, and dishonest with my mother. And in my 30s, living in New York City, I behaved that same way. I was in the wake of the success of Jarhead, but I do think I was also after this thing that I'd experienced when I was 20, which was combat and this high and this exhilaration of having lived, and then coming back and. Like John Berryman says, life, friends, is boring.
Drugs, alcohol, women. Swofford grapples with and slays all the usual demons in those years. But the turbulent relationship with his father haunts him. He writes about it in a new memoir, Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails.
He ran our home a bit like we were his little platoon. And one of my duties was to pick up the dog waste in the backyard. And I was always afraid of missing something and one Saturday morning, I missed, and my father became, physical with me and dragged me by the back of my neck across the yard and essentially pushed my face down toward this mistake of mine. And, it's something that, haunts me now, and that my father and I will still argue about. And I know that it haunts him because he remembers it. Mm-hmm. And it became this rhetorical fight where he would say, well, I did not push your face into this, I pushed your face toward it. I thought it was silly to make that distinction because as a 7-year-old kid being dragged across the yard by his big, powerful 38-year-old father, it didn't really matter. It was an act of terror and something that reverberated with me throughout my childhood and even now.
Why did you write about this? I mean, at many points, you hate this man.
I do. I hated him. I loved him, but I also hated him. I have to give my father credit, though, because, these RV trips that occur in the book, they happened because of him. He asked me to jump in this Winnebago with him.
These are hysterical, riveting trips. You fly across the country to drive with your father from Northern California to Aspen, where you're talking to injured vets about writing. That's the night that you will really have it out by the time you get to Colorado.
Yeah, we're on our way up to the mountain, and I'm a husband now, and my wife is 5 months pregnant. And I really want to break out of this thing with my father, which is me being the son, and I'm really under his yoke. And I realize that I can't just be that anymore. Like, I'm about to be a father, and my behavior has to change. My behavior has changed.
Mm-hmm. This chapter you call "Getting the Venom Out."
Yeah, my father. That's to his credit, he said, "Get your venom out, son. I'm not going to be here much longer, but you'll still be here, and you don't want this hanging around your life when I'm gone." And he was right. And, I finally took him on about not making it to my brother's funeral. I took him on about his long list of infidelities to my mother. And, I have to give him credit. He took it. He was there. He didn't always answer the way I wanted, but he answered for his sins.
So has it been better since then?
It has been. It has been. We can be in a room and I feel safe. We were in a car together recently last week, and I realized that he was about to bring some stuff up, and I think he was going to challenge me about some things. And I just said, "Hey, Dad, I'm not going to play that game. Mm-hmm. I used to, but I'm not anymore. I love you. I hope you love me. I've got a daughter to attend to, and that's really where my energy is going to go now."
Why do you think so many men fight so hard not to become their fathers?
Well, I think the fathers of my generation made mistakes, and we realized that those are models that we don't want to repeat. We want to break the mold and become our own men and become our own fathers. And, you walk into a room with your dad and you're 12 years old, and that, I don't know that ever changes. But for me, what really changed was, becoming a father myself and making that shift and realizing that, that, hey, I'm a father now. I'm not just a son.
Has he read this book?
He hasn't. I'm sending him a copy tomorrow. He wants a signed copy for Father's Day, so I'm going to put it in the mail.
You want to wish him Happy Father's Day?
Yeah, Happy Father's Day, Dad.
Anthony Swofford is the author of the book Jarhead, and his new memoir is called Hotels, Hospitals, and Jails. It was a real pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Jackie.
Not far from Philadelphia, along the Main Line Railroad, is an enchanting garden called Chanticleer. It spans nearly 40 acres. Thousands of people from around the world visit each year, especially on holidays like today, Father's Day. Adrian Higgins wrote a book about it called Chanticleer, A Pleasure Garden.
The directives of the gardeners, spoken and implicit, that underlie the essence of Chanticleer. Be brilliant, be inventive, and do something fresh each year.
As a garden writer for The Washington Post, born in Ireland, raised in England, Adrian Higgins has seen some of the world's best gardens, including Prince Charles' private garden. At Chanticleer in Pennsylvania, he says Americans have an opportunity to visit a garden on that level.
If you want to get back to a garden at its purest and highest level, this is what Chanticleer is.
The Chanticleer estate was created as a mainline retreat by the pharmaceutical magnate Adolf Rosengarten Sr. in 1906. It was the family's escape then, it's yours now. Rosengarten's son, Adolf Jr., expanded it, inspired by the manor house he'd seen while stationed at Bletchley Park in England during World War II. His vision, and the endowment that went with it, was to create a garden for all to share.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Good morning. Everybody have your radio faces on?
Every garden needs its garden elves. Chanticleers gather weekly with Executive Director Bill Thomas. They're going around the table reporting on the work for the week.
Doug Croft, I'm responsible for the vegetable garden, the cut flower garden, and the long border.
Joe Henderson, horticulturalist. I take care of the ponds, gardens, and the Lower Creek garden.
My name's Lucy Dinsmore, and I'll be in the ruin this week and working in Cyclops Creek on Wednesday.
That's right, Cyclops Creek, the ruin. It's like you're walking through Homer's Odyssey. So get your boots on this rainy day and come with us. We're starting near the entrance of the Teacup Garden. The teacup refers to an old stone fountain. Bill Thomas and Adrian Higgins are our guides.
The fountain was originally over at the Chanticleer House, which is the next house that we'll come to. And it was in a lawn area there, and it got a little bit lost in this big lawn. And so by bringing it over to this space in the entrance area, it's in a more intimate space in the fountain seems to be right in scale.
And also the courtyard causes the sound of the water to be amplified, and it gives a very sort of cooling effect in summer, doesn't it, Bill?
Definitely.
And I love the whole sense we're getting, Adrian and Bill, of being in a banana forest. I mean, these, okay, I'm 5 feet. These are well taller than I, and it's just enchanting, really. And I always think, I love the name Teacup Garden because, I'm sorry, I'm looking around for the Hatter, the Dormouse, and Alice, you know. I mean, why not? Why wouldn't I look for them, right? Banana plants ring the fountain, but even more charmingly, really huge ones resemble Doric columns against a stucco house. Nearby is a breathtaking vista. Bill Thomas leads us to the overlook.
Standing on the hill at the Chanticleer House, looking down on what we call the Great Lawn, you can see why the Rosengartens fell in love with the site and decided to move here, to build their house here. And many of the mainline houses, many of the estate houses in this area were built on the top of the hill for the good views, which most people want.
A big purple copper beech tree in the distance anchors the scene. I saw kids rolling down this hill on an earlier sunny visit. And there's texture. Let's take a walk in the gravel garden.
And do you smell the thyme?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my word, that's amazing.
It's a sign of the inventiveness here at Chanticleer that it replaced the formal rose garden with a gravel garden. It's the hottest, driest site on the place, a rocky hillside.
And we have things like, you know, lavender, the thyme, the amsonia. We have the steeper grass. We have the yuccas. What's amazing in bloom at the moment is this purple mallow poppy. What's it called?
It's cup flower.
Works beautifully with the orange asclepias.
But a visitor needn't worry about names. Plants aren't labeled at Chanticleer. It's entertainment. There's what I call the Tim Burton area, the ruin. It uses an old foundation to create a charming, roofless stone mansion.
It's macabre, but in a very sort of entertaining and eye-winking sort of way. There's a table there that sort of, I think it has a sheen of water on it, and it looks a bit like a sarcophagus, you know. It is rather grim and sort of beautifully dark.
And a garden actually is about life and death. A plant lives, it dies, it becomes compost and fertilizes the next crop of plants. The house, in this case, gave up its life so the garden could live. The sarcophagus table, it could be a dining table symbolic of life, it could be a sarcophagus symbolic of death.
And you can actually take your hand and play in this water. And I saw children doing exactly that.
And it's especially good if you splash your brother or your sister while you're here, or your parents.
Nature calls in many ways at Chanticleer. At the farthest edge of the property, the Asian woods, a cooling combination of bamboo forest and stream, it was missing just one thing that visitors always inquire about, the restroom.
Since this is Asian woods, I felt that we wanted something inspired by Asia. And so we actually sent two of our staff members to Japan for a week, and they studied architecture and gardens. I did not want them to study the toilets of Japan, but they, and then they came back and helped us design the structure, which looks very much like a Japanese tea house.
Privately, they call it the Japanese pea house. You get it. It's made of cypress, and it's gorgeous. Then we encounter a rippling pond.
When Chanticleer became this great garden, it sort of looked lonely at the bottom of this hill, so the solution, I think quite clever, was to build a series of terraced ponds above it, so that you then have this sort of coherent necklace of water that is surrounded by these incredible herbaceous beds.
There are six ponds at Chanticleer now, and pink and white water lilies span their surfaces like floating polka dots. Adrian Higgins says it's drama, it's ballet, it's plants on their stage.
It is the alliance of science and art, the science of raising hundreds, thousands of different plants and giving them each their own need. And then there's the art of assembling them
in a way that is visually and sensuously beautiful. There are very few places that do it very well, and Chanticleer is one of them.
Find out for yourself on rainy days when things look especially good. Chanticleer is open Wednesdays through Sundays, April through October, and you can see pictures of it on our website, npr.org. Our visit to Chanticleer was produced by Lauren Silverman.
A moist and lovely day.
Very moist. Let's get something to eat. Mm. Del Parsons is 15 when things begin to change. His quiet life of cohabitation with his family in Great Falls, Montana, is shattered one summer when his parents disappear for a few days. When they come back, they've committed a crime in North Dakota, and it will alter the course of his life forever. It's the kind of grand sweep of an American novel with a Western setting that makes for a satisfying, electrifying summer storm of a tale. Richard Ford is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His latest book is called Canada. And he joins us from member station WABE in Atlanta. Richard Ford, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jackie. Glad to talk to you.
We are very glad to have you with us. So tell us about young Del Parsons. He's a gentle, intelligent young man. Introduce us to him, please, would you?
Well, Del Parsons is a 15-year-old boy who has a twin sister who's a girl, and they are living with their family in Great Falls, Montana. Their father gets out of the Air Force at about age 38 or 39 and pretty quickly falls afoul of some Cree Indians with whom he has entered into a nefarious plot to sell stolen beef, and is so terrified by having been threatened by the Indians that he decides with his wife, quite unwisely, to rob a bank.
Maybe you could just read from the top for us, please.
This is the beginning of the book, Canada. First, I'll tell about the robbery our parents committed, then about the murders which happened later. The robbery is the more important part since it served to set my and my sister's lives on the courses they eventually followed. Nothing would make complete sense without that being told first. Our parents were the least likely two people in the world to rob a bank. They weren't strange people, not obviously criminals. No one would have thought they were destined to end up the way they did. They were just regular, although, of course, that kind of thinking became null and void the moment they did rob a bank.
You take these people and you call them unlikely, and you build up their characters so that, indeed, this does seem exactly as you say, but you also write that as a novelist, that's kind of your job, to draw us into unlikely things actually happening and having consequences.
Right. I think it is my job. I have a theory, and I don't know if my colleagues would agree with it, that someplace at the heart of most compelling stories is something that doesn't make sense. What I mean is that here is a family, if you were flying over them in a balloon, would seem to be nuclear and regular, that they all love each other and they live under one roof and the father is trying to earn a living and the mother teaches school. And the next thing you know, panic ensues and they rob a bank. It was very interesting to me and dramatic, and I thought worth a novel at least.
Richard Ford, I was struck by the fact that the charming Southern-born father, Bev Parsons, short for Beverly, he's been decorated in the Air Force. He sells cars. He looks good. He's handsome. And when he gets into trouble like this, it's a kind of financial panic that I'm thinking when you started writing the book, we might not have been able to imagine as readers as well as we can imagine it today.
It's fairly fortuitous that that should be the case, that this book, which is set in 1960, should in some ways mimic, at least in terms of what happens to the Parsons family, the lives and situations of a lot of Americans and a lot of Europeans and a lot of people all over the world in which they are threatened with the loss of their house, the loss of an income, the loss of a sense of being able to anticipate a hopeful future.
Yes, in this Western expanse. And in fact, what little I know about bank robberies is they are not so uncommon as we might think.
Well, they're not uncommon in the West anyway, because there is a sort of deceptive quality to the West, which is to say that if I can do this and just get out of town, I'll be okay. But of course, when you rob a bank in North Dakota and you run across the border to Montana, you think you're hidden, but in fact, you're the only one out there who's robbed a bank. And you, in fact, are pretty easily detectable.
We're speaking with the novelist Richard Ford about his latest novel, Canada. And it is a grand sweep of a novel. Getting back to Dell, he is not a brash boy. He doesn't have a lot of friends. He likes chess. He likes to read. You set him on really quite a tale. He is spirited away across the border after this. The family falls apart. The parents go to jail. The sister runs away. And Dell is taken by a family friend to Canada.
Right. He is a sheltered boy in lots of ways, unlike his sister, who is brash and who is adventuresome. When the parents are put in jail in Great Falls, Montana, his mother provides for him to get away because she doesn't want him to fall into the clutches of social services and be put in a reform school or into an orphanage. And so he's taken away across into the prairies of Saskatchewan to live with an American who is himself a fugitive from justice.
You lived for a while in Montana and then went to Saskatchewan for this, right?
That's right. It's just the way I think about writing stories. I want to give you a place to reside for a while, since you've chosen to sort of leave what you're thinking and come do something with me. I want to make it worth your while, and it seems to me that I can do that both pictorially by drawing descriptions which take you someplace, but those descriptions are also made up of what I hope is felicitously chose language, and that's a place to reside as well.
Should we still call you, as you have been called, Richard Ford, should we still call you a Southern writer? I mean, you are from Jackson, Mississippi, and were known that way once, but haven't lived there for a long time now.
Well, clearly I haven't scoured Dixie out of my voice.
I'm glad of that.
But, you know, when I quit writing about the South, which was in 1982 when I started writing The Sports Writer, it was largely because I didn't feel like I had anything to say that was new. Everything that I knew about the South was from Eudora and was from Faulkner and mm-hmm. Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy. I didn't feel like I had any news to bring. And so I quit writing about the South at that point. But, you know, if you're born in Jackson, Mississippi, I think you're probably a Southerner all your life. But I don't think that the books that I have written since then, which are 8 in number, have really in any way been Southern in character. I wrote about New Jersey, wrote about Montana, wrote about France. So I probably Southern writer doesn't fit me very comfortably.
I know that you're living in Maine now, and I'm terribly glad you haven't scoured the Southern out of your voice. Do you have any notion where you might take us next, or are you just happy to cruise on this for a while?
Well, I would like to cruise on it for a whole long time, but I probably won't. I'd like to write a memoir of my father. I've written a memoir of my mother,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to write a companion piece about my father and publish it in a book called My Parents. And as a project, that strikes me as a quite attractive project because I've been collecting notes about this for about the last 25 years now. Seems like a propitious moment.
Richard Ford, an honor. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jackie.
Richard Ford, his new book is called Canada. All summer long, we're asking filmmakers, actors, and writers about the movies that they never get tired of watching, including this one from a comedian and actress turned talk show host.
Hey, I'm Whoopi Goldberg, and the movie that I could see a billion, zillion, gazillion times and have is To Kill a Mockingbird, directed by Robert Mulligan. And of course, Gregory Peck is in it, Brock Peters, and just amazing people. I think the first time I saw it, I was probably 10. I was by myself. But I told my mother about it. And I said, "You saw this movie? What's called it?" She said, "Yes, I've seen it. Did you like it?" I said, "Oh my God, it was really great." And Boo Radley, I want him to be my friend. I was an odd child, you know.
Boo only comes out at night. When you're asleep and it's pitch dark. When you wake up at night, you can hear him.
There are a couple of scenes in it that kind of knocked me out, but the very first one that sticks with me is the scene when we first meet Boo Radley. We feel him throughout the film, but we don't actually see him. Boo Radley saves the kids on Halloween night from being hurt by Mr. Ewell.
Run, Scout! Run, Scout! Run, Mr. Ewell!
when you get a character like this, who you're waiting for, and you can't imagine what he looks like, and suddenly...
Oh, there he is, Mr. Tate.
He's behind the door, and the door moves, and it's Robert Duvall, and Scout looks at him, and she says...
Hey, Boo.
Hey, Boo.
Miss Jean Louise, Mr. Arthur Radley.
It just is beyond.
I believe he already knows you.
And those performances are spectacular. It's what I strive for. It's what I want as an actor. I want to be that good. In the midst of all of that, a trial is held that Atticus takes on.
Atticus, you heard about Tom Robinson?
Yes, sir.
It's a black man who's being accused of hitting and coming on to a white woman. And it is very clear, because the black man has only one arm, that there's more to this story than is out there.
There's been some high talk around town to the effect that I shouldn't do much about defending this man.
If you shouldn't be defending him, then why are you doing it?
For a number of reasons. The main one is that if I didn't, I couldn't hold my head up in town. I couldn't even tell you or Jim not to do something again.
For one little kid watching this movie, you sort of get the sense that it is all right to be around people who stand up for what is right and how difficult it can get.
I was to think of these days many times, of Jim and Dill and Boo Radley and Tom Robinson. Atticus.
That's Whoopi Goldberg talking about the movie that she could watch a million times, To Kill a Mockingbird. Bonnie Raitt waited almost 20 years before her first number one album. That was 1989's Nick of Time. Today, she's enjoying another resurgence. Her latest album, Slipstream, is her highest charting record in almost two decades, a fact made all the more impressive because it's the first release on her own label.
You know that your love, you got that hold over me. As long as I've got your love, you know I'll never leave.
But the road back for Bonnie Raitt has taken a toll. Since her last recording, she endured the deaths of her father, the Broadway singer John Raitt, her mother, and her brother, all within 5 years of each other. When I caught up with her backstage before a performance this week, she said she just had to take a break from recording.
I really just wanted to live and not just recover from the losses and go through my brother's things in the estate. But what I did was that was invaluable was I learned to balance taking care of myself and being a good sister and a good girlfriend and friend to my friends and really listening, not just dropping in, because you can avoid real life by being not just a celebrity, but by being on the road all the time. And I just wanted to be Bonnie Raitt without the capitals. You know, I just wanted to see what it was like to live a regular life. And so I really needed and had the luxury of pulling away and taking some time to really grieve and process, so I know how lucky I am.
But the world is always it slips away in full retreat.
Did you tour in the summer times with your father? Did he do summer stage sometimes?
He did 25 consecutive years of summer stock.
I swear I saw him. I feel like I did at a place called the Melody Top in Milwaukee. That my mother would take
me to. He played there.
Yeah,
there was a circuit where the stars of the shows, and in his case, Oklahoma, Pajama Game, Carousel were his big three. He always used to come out in my California shows and sing Oklahoma at the Hollywood Bowl or the Greek Theater, and this audience would stand up and sing it with him, and he'd steal the show every time. And of all the incredible duets that I've been able to sing with, John Raitt was still the one that I just shook in my boots just standing next to him. I loved him so much.
The thing that's known as romance is wonderful, wonderful in every way.
I'm speaking with legendary singer and guitarist Bonnie Raitt. Her new album is called Slipstream. I want to ask a little bit about the title. You know, we were kind of wondering, Slipstream, and I said, isn't that an aeronautical term? Why'd you choose it? I mean, I know now because we looked it up.
Yes, I know.
You tell me why you chose it and what it means to you.
What it means is that it's the kind of ease you get being in the slipstream of people that are going in front. And then it makes your resistance literally, you know, aeronautically or even in a sailboat, you know, you pick up more speed and it's more easy. And I wanted to say that I'm in a slipstream of these styles of music that are always represented on my record. It's not a formula, but I'm honoring those people that I love and whose influence, and I hope that I'm setting a slipstream for those behind me.
You covered a couple of Bob Dylan songs here. Do you ever feel when you are covering someone else, because you almost think of you sometimes as a musical curator, do you ever feel at all intimidated or a bit nervous about covering someone like Dylan?
You know, maybe I should, but I'm so in that slipstream of Joan Baez, Judy Collins, Tony Bennett, my dad. I mean, when they would sing, they didn't look who wrote the song. I mean, they would appreciate it. But, I mean, my great joy is, as you said, thank you for saying it's a curator, because that's how I feel every time I make a record. I should maybe have been intimidated.
No, not necessarily. Have you ever met him?
Oh, yeah. I met him back in my early days at the Gaslight.
And the Gaslight's in?
In New York. Sorry, Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. That's, and my first gigs of any note were there. He heard about me from a waitress there who was a friend. And it was during a period of time after his motorcycle accident where no one had heard from him. She said, you know, a friend of mine wants to meet you. He's heard about you. And she took me to this place. And he answers the door.
Wow.
And he wanted me to come in and play some guitar. So we don't get to see each other very often, but I've known him since then. I'm drifting in and out of dreamless sleep. Somehow my memory's in a ditch so deep. I did so many things I never did intend to do. But I'm still a million miles from you.
I know that as rough as the last few years have been, this album is doing really well. You've landed in the top 10 on Billboard, and that has to be very, very gratifying, because this is the first time that you've done that with the record in about, what, 18 years, I think?
This record has jumped out of the box. This was a phenomenal beginning for me, and to have it be on Red Wing on my own label, it sends a really big signal that it's possible to do this on your own and get some traction.
Did you do anything special to celebrate?
Well,
or did you just play another gig in another town?
You know, it was hard to get sleep for various reasons the first couple of months before. I mean, we were doing promo in the mornings. So, and then there were six-hour rehearsals, and then you go out with your band and your friends and try to fit in some social life. But then, like all of us, we go online to think we're going to pick up on our emails, and then there's all these great reviews coming in. So I was up till really late, you know, just basking and celebrating with people that were already awake in different time zones. It's like it's a thrill when your product comes out, and not only is it well-received, but it's just selling, you know. I mean, it was fantastic. So I guess what I celebrated was not sleeping. You were sleeping in your happy home. When you woke up, baby, your life had come and gone. Now you're mystified, standing with the rest of us who used to rule the world.
I think the time that I remember listening to you the most avidly was the Nick of Time album, of course, beloved album. I was based in Amman, Jordan then. It was the Gulf War, and my ritual between filing, I had some time around 5 o'clock, was to fill the bath, light a candle, and listen to that album.
I'm very, very moved by that. Don't have to humble yourself for me. I ain't your judge or your king.
I remember one of my colleagues gave this to Queen Noor because of the Queen of Sheba line.
Are you serious? And I must tell John Hyatt that. Oh my gosh, who wrote that song? I mean, that is so fantastic. Yeah.
It
makes me so happy that that song reached the end of the world in the middle of that you got out of that time period. I remember being...
It was my sanctuary.
Wow.
It's been just wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out here. It's wonderful to be part of it, Jackie.
That's singer Bonnie Raitt. Her latest album is called Slipstream. You can hear a few tracks on her website, nprmusic.org. We spoke backstage just before her show at Wolf Trap in Vienna, Virginia, this past week. It was more than just any old Friday night fight. With your mean left hook and the roundhouse right. For the week ending June 17, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Brent Bachman. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Walter Ray Watson, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Caitlin Dickerson, Amy Held, and Beenish Ahmed. Michael Tomsic is our intern, Mathoni Maturi, our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Jackie Leiden. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Hey, thanks for tuning in.